So, good morning, everyone. So, as Mike said, my name's Daniel. Few faces I don't know, so lovely to see you. And yeah, we're just going to start this morning continuing our series For the Sake of the World, which we've been going on for a few weeks. And because there's a few people who may be a bit more new to the room, I'm going to cover some ground that we have covered once or twice already. And we'll do that with a diagram, which I admit I was very proud of when I made that. Thank you. And then Adam sent the PowerPoint across. I realised he'd already done it. But I spent so long on it, genuinely, that I had to keep it in. But it's a representation of the passage in Genesis we've been looking at, which says there's a river that flows from Eden, first watering the garden, then out into the world. And in this picture, the river is the Holy Spirit. And you'll notice I even used a water texture. So it's in quite advanced PowerPoint going on. Anyway, so yeah, the garden in there is sort of your inner life. That's what we're talking about here. The garden is, I guess we'll talk about this in a bit more, but your inmost self. And then all those channels you can see are the things that allow that life to grow. They're small but intentional ways that we give God more space in our lives. And what we're really going to try and dig into this week, and just to try and clarify in a way that maybe we haven't so far, is that these are daily acts of submission and surrender. And I think that idea this morning of surrender is going to be really important. And they're as simple as things like silence, practicing silence each day, or solitude, practicing the presence of God, meditating on scripture, all these different things we've been speaking about. And they're not flashy in many ways. One of the wonderful things I think about so much of the gospel is it's not complicated. It's actually really simple, but it brings so much life and they're powerful. And I think this comes back to when we create space for God in our lives, his spirit comes and his spirit fills it. A bit like irrigation, you dig a channel, connect it to a river, and the water flows along. So it's a bit like doing that with your life. You make space, and God fills that space. And in doing that, we receive the love of God. We're changed by that love. We learn to love God more. We learn to love other people more. And we overflow from that into how we treat others and how we engage with the wider world. And I think it's really important to say, and this is kind of a clarifying point on a talk I did a few weeks back, that it's possible to just go through the motions and tick religious boxes. It's really easy to spend time sitting in silence each day because you feel like you should. And this, in doing it like that, sort of robs these acts of their transformative power. And it can be almost unhelpful if we do it like that. But if we use them as an opportunity to submit again to God's leading, Paul puts it like this. Paul puts it as dying daily. So if it's an opportunity for us to die to ourselves daily and put God in charge again, then these acts become that spiritual irrigation that we can see beautifully pictured up there. slightly hurt by your laughter. So anyway, at the moment, think of a dry garden, cracked soil, will actually require a slight bit of imagination right now, but wilting plants, lifeless ground. And then imagine you start digging those irrigation channels, the river flows, and then after some time, life comes. And the point of this metaphor is that what we're really talking about is our soul. We're talking about what happens when we water our souls. And when I say soul, I don't mean like this wispy, smoky, floaty, mystical thing that's very hard to understand or connect with. That's sort of a Greek idea that Christians inherited. But in the Bible, in the biblical sense, when we're talking about our soul, we're talking about your inmost self, your deepest being. It's not some complicated spiritual concept. It's just who you really are inside. And when we talk about watering our garden, we're talking about that, about bringing life to our inmost self. And like any garden, our souls need to be cared for. We have a lot of gardeners in the room. I know that because I get told off when my gardening metaphors are wrong. But our souls need care. They need to be looked after. And if we do, they can flourish and they can grow. And they can also, if we don't care for them, get overgrown and they can get tangled and dry. And from this garden, you can see, a river flows outward into the world. And that flow represents the things that you do that bring the life of Jesus. And sometimes they're in small, everyday moments. And sometimes they're in the big, defining works of your life. But the life of Jesus comes from both of those. And so over the next few weeks, we're going to be exploring what's like a chain reaction as your inner life is transformed, your life is transformed, and then from this place of surrender, it has a growing impact radius on your different communities. It's sort of a ripple outward as you go deeper with God. And it starts with us. The first radius you can see might be your own life. Who you are is transformed. And then you being transformed has a knock-on impact with your relationships, transforming your friends and families and the people that you know well and how you treat them. And then it overflows into our church community. It's really important. We need everyone in our church to be who God made you to be because we all benefit. And then beyond that, the same thing takes place in other communities that you're part of. Workplaces, families, friendships, all this kind of thing. And the wider world beyond that, as you're transformed, you bring transformation. And the point's this, that we're going to be exploring today. Our outer life, how we engage with the world, will always flow from our inner life. Whatever is going on inside will find a way out somehow. And so this morning, we're going to try and dig into the difference between what I put as going through the spiritual motions, doing things because you have to, and living a life of spiritual surrender. And it's a pretty toothsome topic, and there are a couple of different forms this can take. But what I want to look at is what happens on the one hand when you do a lot. This is the first thing we'll look at. And then we'll look at the other, when you don't do anything. And so we're going to kind of compare the difference after that. But first, we want to explore what happens when you do a lot and you're flowing out and you're doing loads of very visible things, but your heart inside is not in a good way. And so we're going to look at that. And basically, we're saying your heart's not in a good way, the garden's not getting watered, but you're doing all kinds of very visible ways of flowing out. And Jesus talks about this in Matthew 23. So he goes into some detail about it, basically talking to the teachers of the law who are called the Pharisees. And they were the people who knew the scriptures inside out. So what we now call the Old Testament, they were the experts on the Old Testament, knowing everything about it. And it's a whole chapter talking specifically to them about how they need to get their hearts in the right place. And Jesus exposes something deeply troubling about them. And that is, in his words, they crush people with unbearable religious demands, and they never even lift a finger to ease that burden. In other words, these people were obsessed with an outward performance. They were obsessed with how their faith looked to other people, but they had no real concern for the hearts of the people that they led. And they had no real concern for their own heart inside. And Jesus presents it with what's a pretty devastating image. He says, you, speaking to them, not to you, you are like whitewashed tombs, beautiful on the outside, but filled on the inside with dead people's bones and all sorts of impurity. And that's a pretty vividly gross image, right? But it would have been more so back then. I think it would have hit very hard. In ancient Israel, tombs were often carved out of rock. And they could be found in sort of these stunning garden-like complexes of different tombs and things like that. So they looked really beautiful on the outside. And you can see it up there, sort of lush greenery, beautiful-looking, whitewashed, well-kept tomb. But then on the inside, it's only death and dry bones and emptiness. And so Jesus is basically saying to them, you look like a perfectly tended garden, but underneath you're a cave full of decay. To everyone else, you seem full of life. You look full of spiritual life, but deep down, it's not true. And that's a challenging thought, I think, because if we're honest, and I think this is maybe even a particularly British trait, we all do this to some degree. I grew up watching this with my nan. Anyone else keeping up appearances? No, not much of a lot. A couple, okay. Older than I look. So basically, it's about we put on a front sometimes, don't we? We make sure everything looks fine, even when beneath the surface it isn't. But sometimes I think you can get carried away worrying about that. Sometimes that's necessary, and it's more about just managing life's ups and downs, and you don't always have to be an open book with everyone. There's that kind of stuff going on. And there's a difference between that and your whole life being an act, your whole life being a performance of being someone you're not to everybody else. And the danger of this, what Jesus is getting at, is that this act you can put on, pretending your spiritual life is what it isn't, catches up with you. And when we keep doing stuff and we keep doing really visible things, but we don't tend to what's going on inside, it can corrode us. It can be very harmful. It leads to stress, to anxiety, burnout, to broken relationships. And worst of all, it can start to hollow out your faith, and your relationship with Jesus can be a point of friction rather than a point of joy in your life. And so when all of our outward actions stop coming from a place of love and a place of connection with God, even the good things we do can become burdensome. If you read Matthew 23, when you get home, Jesus starts to explain how some of the good stuff on paper that they're doing is starting to cause harm because it's coming from the wrong place. And that can happen in our lives. And then, you know, we run the risk of, a bit like the Pharisees, becoming oppressive without meaning to and making people's lives harder rather than joyful. But then this is where things get complicated, because obviously Jesus isn't saying, stop doing good things. That's absolutely not what I want you to take away from this. Instead, he's saying, water the garden first. Look after your soul, and everything flows from that. You don't want to work backwards. And I think it's really important we don't work backwards, because we need to recognize we do all flow out, whether we like it or not. But there's a choice of what it is you're bringing out. You've got, on the one hand, you can flow from a garden, or you can flow from a tomb, and you flow from a garden, you bring life. You flow from a tomb, and you can bring exhaustion, emptiness, burnout, and maybe other even worse things. But if flowing out from a dry place is dangerous, there is an opposite, which Jesus warns about as well, which is you can focus so much on tending your own garden, so to speak, that you never actually leave it. You're so focused on your inner life, your outer life stops altogether. And this is something James warns about in 2:17. It's one of those famous passages, famous because people don't like it very much. He says, faith by itself, if it's not accompanied by action, is dead. This is super challenging, super uncomfortable. And at first glance, it contradicts what I spent the first 10 minutes talking about. That if we flow out, so kind of feels on the surface like it contradicts what I just said. And as I said, it makes a lot of Christians uncomfortable because I think it challenges a specific way of thinking about faith that we in the West and the modern world have, which is that it's a deeply personal experience between you and God. And that as long as you've got a great connection with God right now, then everything's great. As long as you're turning up on Sundays and, you know, you're praying and you feel connected to Jesus, everything else is a bonus. But that is, I think, James' challenge. It's part of a tendency to over-spiritualize how Jesus presents our faith. Jesus' teaching is to imagine that as long... Sorry, I said that wrong again. It's the tiny font I'm struggling with. So we have a tendency to over-spiritualize Jesus' teaching, in which we imagine that as long as we have inner peace, as long as we have an inner connection with God, and as long as our garden's well-watered, then that's all that matters. Then that's the only thing that's important. But James's challenge is that we need to rethink that. And he brings up Rahab, who we looked at last term. You may remember the story of how she saved the spies. And he picks her out as someone who took a huge risk in hiding those spies for the people of God. And he says that it's by this action Rahab was made righteous. And then he gave this really stark and uncomfortable image, which is, as the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without deeds is dead. And so, in other words, faith isn't just about our belief. It isn't just about the heart. Your faith has to move. It has to lead to action. Because a faith that never flows out isn't just incomplete. It's potentially one that's lifeless. Jesus talks about it this way, that a lamp's meant to shine. You shouldn't put a basket on top of it. And then you think about it. If you put a basket on top of a lamp, what will happen? Run out of oxygen. It might go out. It might not just be that it's a very private lamp for the basket and no one else. It might run the risk of burning out altogether. And so the question is that I've been trying to marry up, how do we handle these two very separate feeling ways of thinking about our... slightly daunting lady staring at me. I'll move on for you. There we go. So how do we avoid, on the one hand, the hypocrisy we have of an outward and performative faith, and then on the other, the slight emptiness of an inward-only faith that's never moved to action? And it sounds like a tightrope. It sounds like you're kind of constantly be struggling one way and then the other, but Jesus doesn't see it that way. And in his final conversation with his disciples, recorded in the Gospel of John, John 15, he explains this sort of dynamic to them. And he says, I am the true vine, and my Father is the gardener. He says, abide in me, and I in you, as the branch cannot bear fruit of itself unless it abides in the vine, and neither can you unless you abide in me. I'll read that again. I'm the true vine. My Father is the gardener. Abide in me and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit of itself unless it abides in the vine. Neither can you unless you abide in Jesus. So for a moment, imagine that you are a grapevine. A branch by itself cannot will a grape into existence. The branch is just laying on the floor. It can't try incredibly hard, squeeze its eyes shut, and pop a grape out the branch. That's not how it works. It just abides in the vine. Abiding means it's just kind of part of the vine. It remains connected to the vine, and the grapes then come. If a branch is not connected to the vine, what do you have? It's a stick, I think, at that point. And as far as I know, sticks don't bear fruit. Instead, they dry up, shrivel up, and then they become things that my son plays with. So Jesus' words here couldn't be clearer. If you don't abide in him, then your garden runs the risk of drying up. But if you do abide in him, you will bear much fruit. And I love this passage that we just read. I think it's because I love the word abide. I don't know. For me, it's just got a sort of weightiness to it that I like, and it helps that it's slightly old-fashioned feeling. To me, it speaks of like a deep connection, of staying, of making room, all these kinds of things. And I love that, because to abide in Jesus is to let Jesus abide in you. And it isn't about gritting your teeth. It's not about forcing yourself to be better. It's not about forcing a river to flow from you. It's about surrender. It's about living a surrendered life in which Jesus lives in you. And when you live a surrendered life, you'll do the things that Jesus would do if he were you. And so here's a question, and it's one I think about a lot. When Jesus says, "will produce fruit," what does he mean? Because I grew up in a world where fruit meant specifically evangelism, seeing people saved. And that was the start of the list and the end of the list. But in Ephesians 2:10, Paul explains, we are God's workmanship. I'll say that again, as you are God's workmanship, created in Jesus to do good works, which God prepared in advance for you to do. So it's you are God's workmanship. You were made, you were designed for good. You were made to bring life. You were made to flow out into the world. And these kinds of things that God has prepared for you to do are your fruit. That's what we're talking about here. And it's not just a nice idea. It's not a lovely thought. It's what you are for. It's why you're on earth. It's why God made you how you are. And if you don't do it, then you're missing out on what it is you were created for. I think that's a pretty big thing. And there are good things that the world desperately needs someone to do that won't happen unless you do them, because God has set them for you. And here's the thing. It's one of those catch-22s of scripture. This kind of life doesn't come from obsessing over yourself, which is how we often want to do it. We want to focus so much on our identity in Christ, but instead we need to focus on Christ and surrender. So it's caring less about yourself, caring far more about Jesus, who the one this is all about. And then sort of ironically, it's once you're in that place, once you stop trying to manufacture a sense of purpose and a sense of identity for yourself, that you'll then discover your sense of purpose and your sense of identity. And that is the point at which you truly flow out. That's the point in which you're flowing out in the best possible way. I love how Tom Wright puts it. He says, what you do in the present, this is one of my all-time favorite quotes, I think, so I'll start again. What you do in the present, by painting, preaching, singing, sewing, praying, teaching, building hospitals, digging wells, campaigning for justice, writing poems, caring for the needy, loving your neighbor as yourself. It will last into God's future. These activities are not simply ways of making the present life a little less beastly. They're not ways of making life a little more bearable until the day when we leave it behind altogether. Instead, they are part of what we call building God's kingdom. So a long quote, but a good one, I hope you agree. And it matters because what we're talking about this morning is not how we earn our way into the kingdom. It's how we build the kingdom. And what we build lasts on beyond us into eternity. And right now, we're starting to swim in a world where no one really thinks anything matters at all. It's got a fancy name, sort of existential nihilism. And I share that because a lot of people now that I work with self-identify as nihilist. And it's good to sort of call that out. And nihilism basically means that you believe nothing matters, that there is no purpose to your life or to the world. And so I think that that means our good news today, the gospel and the resurrection of Jesus, has a fresh angle of good news that your life does matter, the things you do matter, because that's such a fresh and uncommon view these days. And I'm just going to move note apps. And just as we finish, I guess, I want to ask the question, where does this leave us? We've summarized the deep connection between our inner life and our outer life, the way that our garden is watered, and the way that our lives should flow outward into the world. We've seen some of the warning signs of a dried up garden that leads to burnout. We've seen a perfectly manicured garden that never bears fruit. The beauty of what happens when we learn to truly abide in Jesus. And so there's an invitation, I think, for this morning to abide in him, to learn to abide, to stay connected to the vine, to let his life flow into yours as if you were part of a branch. Not out of a sense of duty, though, but out of a sense of loving surrender. And if your life feels dry this morning, if you feel like you relate more to the tomb than to the garden, then I just want to remind you that we worship a God who was laid to rest in a tomb and by the power of God was able to walk out the tomb into a garden the next day. And that is the same God we worship today. And it's an invitation that still stands because he's very much still in the business of doing that kind of thing in our lives. And so what will you do this morning? What will be your response to some of what we've been thinking about? Will you make space in your life? Dig those irrigation channels we spoke about. Make time and effort in your life to surrender. It could be as simple as a small act each day, 5 minutes of silence, 5 minutes of meditation, practicing the presence. It could be any of these things, but to take a step forward in surrender to Jesus in your life, make more room for him. Because when we do, we'll be reminded and sort of fueled by this reminder that everything we do once surrendered to Jesus matters. Everything we do when we're surrendered to Jesus has a huge impact on the world, lasts beyond ourselves. And so just to finish, I guess I want to make that invitation again to come and abide in Jesus.